forum, and it gives me a great pleasure to introduce you to our guest speaker, visiting scholar with Dr. Al Lingua, Listen Project, Dr. Tomasa Milani, from the University of Oxford in Johannesburg. Tomasa Milani is an associate professor in linguistics and the head of department, and he joined the University of Witwatersrand in 2009. During his academic career, Tomasa has been working really in a range of fields and topics, including social linguistics, critical discourse analysis, research on multimodality, language politics and language ideologies, as well as language, gender, and sexuality, with a focus on masculinities. His most recent work on gender and sexuality include an article titled Recasting Language and Masculinities, which appeared in a special issue in Language and Gender 2011, a chapter on beer, masculinity, and social change, which appears this year in a book on gender and language in sub-Saharan Africa, edited by Adanga, Elise, Little Saliti, and Sunderland, and a chapter on queering masculinities, which also will appear in the second edition of the Blackwell Handbook of Language and Gender, edited by Miriam Mayaho and Susan Ehrlich. And today, Tomasa will talk about the queer art of failure, loss and desire of in consumerist times. And he will talk some 45 minutes, and we will then have plenty of time for questions and comments and discussion afterwards. So let us welcome Tomasa here.
Thank you very much, Kati, for the nice presentation. So it's a small forum. So, I mean, if you want to stop me at any time, just stop me, okay? Let me see if it works. Okay, with this talk, I aim to provide a hopefully different, a better queer perspective on gender and sexuality in contemporary advertising. Before delving into the analysis of relevant text, I want to spend some time outlining the empirical and theoretical difference of this paper from other papers in the literature. So let me start with the empirical. Paul Baerbacher has poignantly argued that advertising links gender identity and sexual desire with almost any product that may be purchased. Cars, cigarettes, food, holidays, insurance, sports and hobbies, clothing, furniture, film. This is indeed very true, and it is not only gender identity and sexual desire that are mobilized by advertisers. Race, ethnicity, social class, age are also key categories that are strategically employed in advertisements for consumerist purposes. As soon as we switch on the TV or the computer or thumb through the glossy pages of a lifestyle magazine, there is no doubt that advertisers seem to be constantly searching for and offering a new and fresh take on, say, masculinity or race. But then once you scratch under the surface, you realize that they are just mere reproduction of the status quo. A case in point in the South African context is this advertisement that I've analyzed in the chapter that Kathy mentioned. It's advertisement about a beer. It's the Carling Black Label True Men TV commercial. And if you look at, I'm not showing it because we won't have time, but if you look at the advertisement of what the Carling Black Label is trying to frame, this new man, the new South African man, but when you start analyzing through critical discourse analysis, you know, the result is there's nothing new about the new South African man. It's just another boring version of the old heterosexual masculinity, which in order to sell beer is, however, presented under a new guise that is more palatable to modern societal conditions and is more in tune with the middle-class aspirations in the South African context. But being disappointed in the ways in which heterosexuality is constantly mobilized for consumerist purpose does not mean that I'm happy with the ways in which homosexuality has recently been incorporated into advertising with a view to attracting an affluent homosexual constituency of consumers. And you might think that I'm becoming an old grump, unhappy with everything, but think about the many happy gay and fewer lesbian couples that have cropped up in different advertisements with a view to sap actually attracting the pink pound or the pink dollar or the pink euro. And, you know, there are many of those. And one could say that these are prime instances of a burgeoning homonormativity that has been defined by Lisa Duggan as a politics that does not contest dominant heteronormative assumptions and institutions, but upholds and sustains them while promising the possibility of a demobilized gay constituency and a privatized, depoliticized gay culture anchored in domesticity and consumption. I mean, you know, people like Lisa Duggan have tried to problematize the way in which homosexuality and homosexual constituencies actually can reproduce rather than contest heteronormative assumptions. Against this backdrop of these dissatisfactions, and in view of my particular interest in gender and sexuality, I've searched for more ambiguous advertisements. Advertisements which cannot be easily pigeonholed, or advertisements that raise questions and partly unsettle entrenched beliefs about gender and sexuality. And I mean, it has been a very, very hard search, because ambiguous advertisements, there aren't many, right? But no sooner than, and this is like the first difference. In other words, the difference of the paper. I'm going to present you two advertisements that are tricky in many ways, that many other advertisements have been analyzed in the literature are not. But no sooner than I started analyzing this new ambiguous advertisement was I met by the dilemma or whether they could be read through the lens of a nearly ubiquitous concept in sociolinguistics and critical discourse analysis, namely the notion of identity. And this is the second difference of this paper. This paper is a critique of the notion of identity, and I'll argue that we need something else to analyze this advertisement. So, but before I go into the analysis, bear with me and allow me to spend some time presenting briefly the debates about identity in language, gender, and sexuality research, because they will allow me to highlight the difference of this paper, namely the reliance on a theoretical apparatus that has rarely been employed in sociolinguistics and discourse analysis. Until recently, the study of language and gender on the one hand and research on language and sexuality on the other have been characterized by a rather clear-cut divide that has led to their development as two separate strands of sociolinguistic, linguistic-anthropological, and critical discourse analytical inquiry. At the risk of falling into undue oversimplification, Paul Baker has suggested that books on language and gender tend to have nominally heterosexual men and women as their subject, whereas those on language and sexuality tend to be written about nominally gay men and, to a slightly lesser extent, lesbians. Yet in more recent years, there have been enhanced awareness of the flaws of such a separation. So hence, scholars have begun to explore more carefully how gender and sexuality intersect with one another and with other axes of social categorization. And this afternoon, we're going to talk much more about intersectionality, which is another problematic concept, but we'll wait until this afternoon. And according to Deborah Cameron, this academic rapprochement between language and gender, language and sexuality, is part and parcel of a shift towards diversity and a thrust to go beyond reality and engage with the domain of representation. Growing out of the discursive turn in the social sciences, coupled with the feminist concern with gender inequalities, this paradigm shift has less to do with the will to dismiss reality as an inadequate object of inquiry than to provide a more nuanced picture of how reality and representation are closely intertwined. In practice, an approach that takes into account the relationship between reality and representation has entailed an abandoning of a view of gender and sexuality as pre-existing categories that are reflected in linguistic performances, so you know, the I'm sure you know all about this. Like, women use more hedges than men. Men do rapport talk, whilst women do rapport talk. Gay men use more nuanced colored terms, while their heterosexual counterparts cannot be bothered. Now, this is just old stuff, right? And priority now is given to investigating how individuals perform gender and sexuality in different ways, creatively deploying linguistic means which allow them to align or disalign from cultural scripts of masculinity that circulate in a specific sociocultural context. That said, Cameron Culit pointed out that whether targeting normative or non-normative participants, research on gender and sexuality has been constrained within the straitjacket of the notion of identity. And this is something Cameron Culit argued in 2003, but hasn't been taken up very seriously, in my view, by researchers working in sociolinguistics. They define identity as a kind of conscious claim staking by a subject who knows exactly who she is or wants to be, or who she isn't and doesn't want to be. As an alternative, Cameron Culit proposed going beyond the analysis of acts of gender and sexual identities so as to account for the realm of desire and the unconscious. To begin with, inspired by the work of Lacan, Cameron and Culit assert that desire is always transitive, that is, it is always for another person or object. Therefore, taking desire as an analytical object compels us to problematize both the subject and the object of desire, and investigate how the relationships between the two are materialized through language. Related to this, a focus on desire helps to capture the Gordian knot of gender, sexuality, and other forms of social difference. After all, as Cameron and Culit remind us, desiring subjects and desired objects are never genderless. Thus, the domain of the erotic is inherently structured along gender lines, which in turn are likely to be laminated over by other axes of social categorization, such as age, social class, and race. So these arguments generated a flurry of reaction critiquing the proposal of bringing desire and the unconscious into the study of language, gender, and sexuality. Mary Buckles and Kara Hall were perhaps the strongest opponents, raising important theoretical and methodological issues. The main problem, they argued, lies in the fact that the psychoanalytic theories on which Cameron and Culit arguments rest do not offer adequate analytical tools for the empirical study of the ways in which desire is materialized through language. What they would require sociolinguists, linguistic anthropologists, and discourse analysts to reinvent themselves as field psychoanalysts, ascribing repressed desire to those they study. Moreover, in stating that desire is always mediated in some way by identity, that is, longing is always articulated through and against statements of belonging, they also level a more fundamental objection to the notion of desire itself as inherently a byproduct of identity. What is striking to me is the fact that Buckles and Hall seem to discard a priori psychoanalysis from the possibility of giving insight into language, gender, and sexuality. This is particularly interesting because much of the work of one of the most cited scholars in language, gender, and sexuality, namely Judith Butler, rests heavily on psychoanalytical grounds. But no one seems to take this into account. You know, people constantly refer to Judith Butler, people use Judith Butler, but people never actually engage with the fact that all her theory of performativity is actually based on psychoanalysis. This note aside, the debate, fight even, between Buckles and Hall on the one side of the trenches and Cameron and Culit on the other, remained at a high level of abstraction. And to date, there have been little work that has tried to operationalize Cameron and Culit's proposal of analyzing desire. And this is another thing that intrigues me, how certain theories kind of get taken up by a lot of scholars throughout the world, and some others that have similar characteristics kind of fizzle out and they get never really, no one really engaged with them. So in the case, to me it's interesting, for example, how intersectionality, which is as buzzword, as vague, as desire in many ways, has become hegemonic, especially in Sweden, in Germany, and in other contexts. Whereas, for example, although it hasn't really come into sociolinguistic prominently yet, but the notion of desire, which instead is very much used, you know, in literary theories and so on, has not been taken up in sociolinguistics and completely discarded. The debate fizzled out. No one deals with it. Okay, it is with a view to partly redressing this scholarly vacuum that I will draw upon the notion of desire together with other psychoanalytical tools in the paper. And I have to say, this is the first paper that I write, you know, using psychoanalysis. I will do so in order to engage with current work in queer theory, which has brought up the potential inherent in the notion of failure. So what I want to mention that my analysis has been ignited by recent work by Jack, Judith Arbuston, he, she signs using both, well, either a male or female name, in the recent book, The Queer Art of Failure. There she signs as Judith, so I say she. She postulates that under certain circumstances, failing, losing, forgetting, unmaking, undoing, unbecoming, not knowing, may in fact offer more creative, more cooperative, more surprising ways of being in the world. Failing is something queers do and have always done exceptionally well. For queers, failure can be a star of a way of life, and it can stand in contrast to the grim scenarios of success that depend upon trying and trying again. And in order to understand what she means, she defines failure as a refusal of mastery, a critique of the intuitive connections within capitalism between success and profit, and as a counter-hegemonic discourse of losing. But let us ask ourselves, is all failure queer? And what is queer after all? So let us begin with the latter. So in line with Halperin, I define queer as anything that is at odds with the normal, the legitimate. Queer is also a particular sensibility that constantly questions sexual identity categories and any other categories. So from a queer perspective, gay, lesbian, heterosexual, bisexual are very problematic categories, right? And from a queer theoretical perspective, we should always try to separate practices, so a man desiring or having sex with another man, from identity, gay. The two are different, right? And the queer perspective would say that we need to separate them. So in this way, queer is not synonymous with LGBTIA through Z, which is becoming nearly pathetic, and movements and forms of identification. So is all failure necessarily at odds with the normal, the legitimate? Is failure always questioning identity categories? But isn't failure constantly incorporated into the consumerist system and is part and parcel of the architecture of advertising? As soon as you switch the TV on or open a lifestyle magazine, you will realize that you are failing. You're failing to take care of your bodies. You are failing to eat the right food, whatever this may mean. Hence, we need advertisement, or also our personal experts, to tell us how we should make our skin better, improve our digestion, or plan our retirement in the right way. Are these advertisements queer? I would say no. So are there advertisements that leave failure unresolved? And what kind of failure? These are questions which I'm going to address in this talk, and I will do so by looking at two commercials of the global north. One for the Austrian version of IKEA, the other one for the Swedish postal service, which offers to redirect your post when you move, adressändring. I assume that you all understand Swedish, right? At least basic one. You might struggle to see where failure lies in the first one, but it will appear fairly clearly in the second one. But I hope that by the end of the talk, it will have become clear what I mean by failure and how it remains unresolved in both advertisements. But let us start with watching the first advertisement. Before I delve into the analysis of this commercial, I want to highlight how this advertisement has been labeled on YouTube as a gay-bisexual IKEA commercial in Austria. Taking a queer stance, I want first to problematize this act of positioning. From a queer theoretical perspective, one should avoid too easy conflation between processes, a man or a woman's desire for another man or woman with identities, so gay, heterosexual, lesbian, bisexual. Is Florian's behavior to be understood as gay or bisexual? Isn't the notion of desire more productive here to understand what Florian does rather than who he is? After all, he never says anything about it. I mean, he doesn't say like, oh, I'm bisexual, oh, I'm gay, right? But let us start from the beginning. The opening scene doesn't need much explanation. A rush of apparently heterosexual libido. A man and a woman running up the stairs of an old, probably Viennese apartment block. The explosions of feelings, the undressing, the succumbing of the woman to the passion of the man. A prelude to the sexual act, accompanied and boosted by the soundtrack of Bach's First Cello Suite. Until the door opens. If until that moment we had thought that Florian's acts would be the manifestation of heterosexual desire, the appearance of a man through the door, uttering the German equivalent of, honey, I'm home, unsettles and complexifies the picture. To use Freud, this is an uncanny moment. The uncanny is something that appears to be familiar, which, however, at the second glance is unfamiliar and turns unexpected. As Freud explained, unheimlich, which is uncanny in German, also bears the meaning of, and here I quote, being concealed, kept from sight, so that others do not get to know about it, withheld from others. How very appropriate to describe Florian's adventure on the down low. And as Freud would add from a psychoanalytical perspective, and here I quote again, the uncanny is something familiar which has been repressed. In this case, it's human beings' inherent bisexual libido. I find the conclusion of the advertisement particularly intriguing. On the one hand, one could argue that the advertisement relies on a fairly conventional trope, the familial order, which was momentarily, although surreptitiously disrupted, is reconstituted, as is testified by the scene with Florian sitting hands in hand with his partner at the same sturdy IKEA table which had been the site in which heterosexual desire was about to translate into a sexual act. Note how the symbolic order is metaphorically manifested in the meeting of the feet under the table. And the black sock against the white feet, then the yin and yang and all that thing, you know, is there. You know, you see how the family, you know, the roof is reconstituted metaphorically. And heterosexuality is sent back into the closet, quite literally. Not homosexuality, but heterosexuality in the closet, right? Which is illustrated by the woman furtive picking up of the shoes and closing the cabinet door. Again, very sturdy IKEA, right? Most notably, the advertisement has an open ending. You know, heterosexuality continues to haunt the homosexual order as reinforced by the voiceover, Florian has things to hide. The woman is there in the closet, right? Of course, the representation of a man in a relationship with another man and having sex with a woman is not a new trope. One can just think of the famous La Cage aux Folles, which has been popularized in different movies and theater performances. But the trope here has been mobilized for a particular consumerist purpose, selling IKEA furniture. I mean, this is the whole point, I mean. What is particularly interesting is how a popular furniture producer goes against societal normativity in three ways. So, remember, this is also Austria, right? So Catholic, mainly Catholic. Also, there are country. There's Protestants, but Austria is a very conservative, a relatively conservative society, right? Not only is homosexual desire exploited for commercial purpose, which, however, could be said to be the manifestation of a burgeoning homonormativity, just mentioned before, but, and this is to me the queer aspect, such desire is destabilized by the threat of heterosexuality. So it goes complete against the typical trope. Like, you know, it's not homosexuality that threats heterosexuality, but it's heterosexuality that threats homosexuality, which is quite interesting. Most crucially, IKEA is actually capitalizing quite literally on a well-spread but nonetheless societally repressed behavior, namely unfaithfulness. And this is, to me, tricky because of in the context of Austria, right? As a way to marketize their products. In that way, one could argue that IKEA is going against the grain, unsettling societal expectation of what counts as normal and acceptable for consumerist purposes. Something which has been picked up very strongly in the many postings about the YouTube video. You know, the people who watched the YouTube video, then they were very unsettled by the fact that there is unfaithfulness as a key element of the advertisement. But where is failure here? Bear with me a second. Let's have a look at the other one.
Paris, 2nd of June, 1989. My darling Shell, my little bonbon. I have been in love with you since the second I saw you. You stole my heart and you took it with you back to Sweden. This is the third time I write you. Please answer. Shell, come live with me at Paris.
Okay, this is to me a very interesting one. It came out last year in August in Sweden. And, yeah. Analogous to those Italian Renaissance painting where a sunny and positive representation of good rule is juxtaposed to a darker, negative, oppressive, dystopic image of the bad rule, it appears clear that this advertisement is the photographic negative of the previous one. I mean, do you understand? I mean, the previous one was like, joyful and, you know, the sex and everything. And it was like happy. This is like gloomy. Right? You see that it's like two different, although they deal with very similar thing, right? Whereas in the previous one, the stability of homosexual desire institutionalized and enshrined in the homosexual couple living together is unsettled by heterosexuality. Here, it is the very heart of heterosexual desire and the heterosexual couple that is questioned. But whilst the previous advertisement was full of happiness, here it is sadness and disenchantment. And this, again, is picked up a lot in the postings on YouTube where people are like, oh, stacca Shell, I mean, poor Shell. I mean, people kind of get nearly touched by this man. I mean, no one said, like, stacca Brit Marie. I mean, no one care about her, right? Because she's seen as terrible, right? And she even says no to his croissant. So everyone's like, oh, poor, you know, he's poor him. You know? And it's interesting how affect is mobilized. And again, you know, there is a consumerist element here. And ultimately, the whole idea is that you should pay the 500 crowns, kronur, for address ending, so that your life, you know, will not run the risk of ending up with a Brit Marie, for you will be unhappy. So it is the rather depressing story of Shell, narrated in the first half of the advertisement by his young French lover living in Paris. A lover who has never forgotten about the young blonde Swede whom he had met 10 years before. Read through a post-colonial lens, the advertisement relies heavily on an ethnic racial juxtaposition of the stereotypical image of the blonde, slim, attractive, smooth Swedish adolescent and the no less attractive, young, smooth, slim, but darker, exotic French of Maghrebi origins. If we believe that heterosexual desire and practices are typically what is considered normal by society, whereas homosexuality is what is deemed deviant, then the young couple enshrines two opposite, one which embodies the domain of the deviant, the French boy man, reinstates his homosexual desire for Shell, sending him 3 letters inviting him to move to Paris and settle down in a homosexual couple. But the other one, Shell has changed address, has moved on, not only literally but also sexually. The deviant has been left outside in the foreign land, and upon return to Sweden, Shell has repressed the exotic homosexual desire, has entered back into the domain of normality by moving in with Brit Marie into a fairly wealthy suburban home in a non-well-specified suburb. That said, homosexual desire hasn't been fully dissipated from the heterosexual familiar picture. And once again, good old Freud can help us explain what's going on through Shell. This time I will draw upon his concept of melancholia. According to Freud, melancholia is similar to mourning, right? Insofar as it's a process that occurs in connection with the loss of a person or thing. However, unlike when you mourn for someone who has died, where the ego progressively retracts its libidinal energies, in melancholia it doesn't. So in other words, it's a loss of somebody, but you don't retract your desire for that object or person, but the ego gets fixated, continuing pumping libidinal energy towards someone or something that cannot be possessed. And precisely because the object of desire has been lost and cannot be possessed, the ego, and here Freud used the words interjects. So the ego interjects the lost object of desire into him itself. And to me, this is applicable to the advertisement under investigation, where the narration which opened the ad could be interpreted as the manifestation of a daydreaming. We don't know, actually, if the Maghrebi French is the one who is telling the story. Perhaps it's actually just a voice in Shell's mind, right? It's not too far-fetched to believe that actually, he's there, he's in his thought and he's thinking about this French lover. Perhaps it's not the French lover who is speaking, but it's actually his double, to use again Otto Rank, another psychoanalyst, introjected into Shell's psyche, who reemerges when Shell is preparing the coffee for his overall dissatisfied partner, Brit Marie. Now, when you work with psychoanalytical tools, objects become also very interesting. And this advertisement is really a bit of a pearl in terms of the level of detail that there is. Note in particular how Shell has projected his loss into the material object of the cup. I mean, Paris, right? Bearing the image of the Eiffel Tower and the croissant, which is promptly dismissed by the rather dissatisfied and bored female partner. If we want to take psychoanalysis to the bitter end, one could suggest that the croissant is a metaphor for the phallus, which brings Shell into a situation of double rejection. He has repressed his homosexual desire by incorporating his habitual desire into the ego, but his heterosexual desire is rejected by the partner. So he's really failing one after the other, right, this poor shell. So they are right, you know, the people who say, like, stuck a shell. Yeah, he's in a double bind. Now, this is to me a clear example of failure. It's an example of life failure. A failure which would not have happened if Shelley had paid for a dress ending, right? As such, one could argue that failure has been incorporated into the consumerist logic of capitalism in the same way as a dieting product might help us to overcome our failure to have a perfect body, a dress ending helps minimize the possibility of a missed chance of a life partner. Yet, there is a big difference here. Whereas the dieting product relies on the logic clearly spelled out in the quote by Halberstam with which I started this talk, "Try again and you will achieve it." A lost opportunity of a life partner is forever. Shell's failure, as presented in the advertisement, cannot be repaired. Unlike the IKEA advertisement, where order is recreated, the address ending one finished with disorder and unsettlement. Even if Shell left the suburban home and used address ending, the young French lover would not be brought back. And it is this sense of despair that is commented on by the many commentators on YouTube. So, to go back to the question with which I opened this talk, are these advertisements queer? And is failure queer? Now, you're going to be very disappointed with me, because in a queer theoretical fashion, I'm reluctant to bring closure to this question. I'm not going to say yes or no, right? The answer is both yes and no. On the one hand, one could suggest that both advertisements are queer because they rely less on sexual identity categories than, in my view, on sexual desire. Furthermore, they both capitalized on a specific type of failure. And here where the two are connected, the failure to comply with a clear-cut homo-hetero binary. You can't box these people anywhere, in my view. The first advertisement questions and unsettles the stability of homosexual desire, whereas the second one disturbs the very heart on which heterosexuality rests. Such failure to adhere to stereotypical sexual norms ultimately reminds us, as Freud has cogently pointed out, that we are all polymorphously perverse. What is more disconcerting is how the unsettling of the homo-hetero divide has been introjected, and I use intentionally the psychoanalytical term, into the system of capitalist production, and has become part and parcel of a broader consumerist project of consumption. Ultimately, these advertisements are geared to making IKEA furniture and address ending services sell. But if one believes that commercial advertising is intrinsically a tool through which consumerism is reproduced and promoted, I mean, if we accept that ultimately, you know, as soon as you look at an advertisement, that's consumerist, right? Then these adverts might not unsettle the capitalist logic on which advertising relies, but are rare gems that query, pun intended, the seemingly normal and widely accepted nature of the homo-heterosexual divide itself, and thus destabilize the very truth of that normality. Thank you. I'm not sure how much time it went. Was it 45 or just...
It was 35.
Okay, fine. So we have plenty of time for discussion, yeah. So your thoughts, you know, we can have quite a discussion here. Yeah.
Thank you for a very interesting talk, although you've shown us some very sad stories too. I'm very interested in what you were saying about the fact that the notion of desire never made it to socialism. And I actually, we talked about this with Monica Heller the other day. She said that
Well, we concluded that it's actually because it seems like in social linguistics today, the emphasis is on resources rather than desire. And people desire resources if they are understood in a very large sense. But could you actually, what are your thoughts about it? Why is it so difficult to incorporate these notions coming from psychoanalysis in sociolinguistics, or even notions like the notion of performativity? This was like 10 or 15 years ago when Anna Lingers and Kira book came out, and for me it seemed from the very beginning that this would be a very difficult enterprise, and I don't think it has happened. I'd be interested in knowing what your thoughts are.
Okay, I mean, I guess, you know, sociolinguists are interested in the social aspect, right, of language, right, which means that this brings immediately to discard desire, because sociolinguists think that desire and any psychoanalytical tool is an attempt to dissect your brain or mind. Whereas, you know, people like, you know, Don Kulik and Deborah Cameron, but also Judith Butler herself, you know, there are ways through which you can actually see desire in psychoanalysis as a social process. No one is interested in actually looking at, you know, what's going on in your mind. No one is gonna try to have like a psychoanalytical session with you, but it's like to understand the way in which, by saying certain things and not others, well, these what you say can be actually traced back through some and made sense of through some psychoanalytical tool. So that's why, in a sense, I disagree with Mary Buckles and Kira Hall when they kind of say, like, well, you know, look, you know, this would require us to turn into a full psychoanalyst. Well, you know, people who work in literary studies, they use psychoanalytical tools, and they're not certainly trying to say anything about the life of, say, Henry James or what his psychopathologies were, right? It's like tools. But I think, you know, sociolinguists have dismissed it because there is the belief that you lose touch with the social, right? And you kind of trying to bring it back to the psychic. And that's where the social psycho-divide comes in. But I instead see psychoanalysis and the tools as, in the same way as we use performativity theory, I think that we can use the uncanny, I think we can use melancholia, I think we can use lots of other concepts, as long as we are clear that we look at how these concepts are kind of heuristic lenses that allow us to understand the social. I'm not sure whether I answered your question. And just to add a couple of things, like, I think the other reason why desire didn't take off is that the debate became very personal between Cameron and Kulik on one hand and Buckles and Hall on the other. I also believe that the way in which Cameron and Kulik define identity kind of made them shooting their own foot, right? Because they have this kind of conscious claim staking, which of course then Buckles and Hall went at their juggle of being. No one has ever said that there should be, you know, identity, something conscious. So I think that debate, as often happened in this debate, like, things, people got sidetracked by details in each other's argumentation, and then which then diluted the whole proposal of engaging with desire, which is to me something that I'm trying to recast, because I believe that actually the notion of identity can't always be applied, and also because I believe that if we as sociolinguists have identity,
as our main goal, and we are like, it's just as if sometimes if we are constantly bending, trying to find something, and we are missing the big elephant that is passing behind us, right? And because you know, sometimes in these interactions, we try to pinpoint all the identity positions, but there's lots more going on, and that gets lost, especially when talking about gender and sexuality. There was one there, and then...
Yeah, I felt sorry for Brit Marie.
You felt sorry for Brit Marie.
Yeah. I was thinking about desire. This is not really scientific or anything, but it was interesting how desire was something that you couldn't get, especially in the last commercial, was kind of highest in the hierarchy of things that you ought to be like following and that you shouldn't suppress or anything. And by that, they are trying to sell you, like it's the gabietti, like the
instinct.
Like the highest instinct that you ought to be following, and if you don't do that, you get really miserable.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, we can. Yeah, there is that reading is possible. Yes, that reading is possible. Although it's interesting how that basically never talk, thank goodness, about your true self, right? You know, it's more about possible turns in people's lives. And that's why it's ambiguous. Because they say, in Swedish, they say, you know, life could have gone very differently. But they never say that one would be the right and the, well, of course, I mean, he's unhappy, right, in the marriage with Brit Marie. But perhaps it's just because Brit Marie is just extremely boring, right, as a woman, right? You know, but what I'm trying to say is that to me, the adversary one is a very, very crafty one where they leave all possible interpretation open. Right?
Yeah, I was just thinking what you said about the resources hypothesis, that we're concentrating on resources, but I'm not quite sure if it holds, because what has been taken into social linguistics, is the notion of affect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely, it's not the same, it comes from a different direction, but I guess there is a growing interest in, for instance, Anita Pavlenko has been trying to combine the social and the psychological, so I do think there is something that resonates at least with those interests. And the second comment, the argument that it goes too deep into the psyche, I don't know, because in feminist media studies, people are definitely drawing on psychoanalysis and not doing any psychological analysis.
No.
And that's, I guess, it's the difference. I don't think that it necessarily helps the argument that it would require, like, psychological training or trying to get into the brain in that sense.
Yeah. But I mean, I think also in sociolinguistics, sociolinguists have a lot of investment in identity. We teach courses in language and identity. I have written, you know, papers after papers about identity. But you realize, and this I'm not because that's the other big misunderstanding in the debate. I'm not saying that we should discard identity. I'm not saying that we should throw identity out with the baby, right, and the bottle of water. I'm just saying that perhaps sometimes, especially when you work with sexuality, identity is just not enough, right? And you have to engage with other things, because otherwise you leave out more than half of the picture, right? And you're just oversimplifying. So that's what was misunderstood in the debate with Cameron and Kulik. You know, people felt very threatened by the fact that, oh my God, like, what are we going to write about if we don't write about identity, right? It's like, you know, Cameron said, well, of course you can continue writing about identity, but, you know, if you do look at a specific set of data, then perhaps you might need to incorporate other notion. That's where desire came into the picture. And also, I think people like Monica Heller, and I'm not trying to position her in any way. I mean, she's very much what I would call a materialist. So she's very much into material conditions, which is absolutely fine, which means that when you have that specific lens, when you start looking at desire, well, it becomes less relevant because the focus is on something different, right? And in terms, because I mean, she works very much with Bourdieu notions of you know, the market and the linguistic marketplace, and again, resources, that where the resources and value, you know, it's a whole tradition with another type of language, metaphors, right? Which I mean, it's fantastic, but and it might work very well, you know, with the kind of issues of multilingualism with which she grapples with. But it doesn't work very well here in my advertisements, in my view. Mm. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Wow, one needs to probably look at the advertisement many times to get into the layers.
Yeah.
I mean, but it was just very fascinating. I guess I'm asking this because I'm not really into. I'm not very familiar with the psychoanalytical debates,
mm-hmm.
and I guess. What I would be interested in hearing, if you could say something about the ways in which, in the context where you come from now,
mm-hmm.
which is South African
yep.
academic circles, how are these debates of psychoanalysis using Freud being debated
mm-hmm.
outside of European
mm-hmm.
context? And I guess what I'm kind of,
mm-hmm.
Why I'm asking this is that I'm kind of, the literatures that I'm trying to engage myself in my own research is the post-colonial
mm.
and the women of color, etc., etc.
Mm.
And I guess my question has always been to colleagues using psychoanalysis, is it universal? Can
mm.
what are there alternatives? What can we combine it with, etc.,
mm.
etc., et without turning it into a colonialist,
mm.
imperialist
mm.
analysis?
Mm. No, it's a very good question, a very relevant question, and it's not just about psychoanalysis, but it's generally about any type of theoretical scaffolding that has been created in the West, the North, whatever you want to call, like non-Africa, right? And there is, we are having a huge debate right now at my university in Johannesburg, precisely in conjunction with the Komarov's latest book, A Theory from the South. And I'm gonna answer you in a general way, rather than focusing specifically on psychoanalysis, because your point could be has been raised very, very sharply and against queer theory. Being a theoretical scaffolding creating the United States, well, that has burgeoned in the United States. Right? I certainly do not believe in anything that is universal. So, Freud's theories were extrapolated out of the Viennese bourgeois context of the turn of the century. Right? So it says something about a specific set of what he called patients, right? Who had a specific social class background at a specific moment in time. However, in the same way as queer theory grew out of a dissatisfaction in the 80s with a specific type of identity politics that was going on in the United States, whereby, you know, radical feminists were saying, I don't identify with that gay and lesbian that you are going out with the flag and whatever. Like, I don't fit into that umbrella to it. Right? And it was like, we should think in new ways, especially in a time where AIDS was broke out, and where the medias were representing AIDS as a gay plague. It was like, hold on a second, this has nothing to do with identities. You can get AIDS. Whether you're gay, black, white, heterosexual, it has to do with practices, with what you do, with whom and how, rather than who you are, right? If you are white and heterosexual, it doesn't mean that you have a condom around your body, right? So the question now to answer, like, okay, can we apply something that's being created at a specific moment in time, in a specific context, to another context that is very, very different? And again, you might think that I'm being very ambiguous. It's yes and no. Yes, because I believe that there is no need to reinvent the wheel all the time. If a theory from the South means a theory created by Africans, are we talking about, I mean, do I count as African because I am based at an African university? Or out of African data? Well, it becomes a very essentialistic argument. Right? My point is that each and every theory, wherever it's being created, has to be applied with a skeptical stance. If it allows to say something about the context in which you're working, fine, but you have to acknowledge how we can speak back to theory. How does the theory, I'm more interested in the case where the theory doesn't work, and why it doesn't work, and instead of dismissing the theory altogether, how we can actually refine the theory through the lens of the data from the South, so from a post-colonial lens, for example. So in other words, in my view, Freud works in the same way as queer theory works, as long as we are skeptical about them and we talk about the limitations and we talk about how we can refine some concepts with the help of our empirical data. I mean, one of the main critiques against queer theory, for example, is that they say, well, you know, in South Africa, the very adjective queer is not used. It's like, I mean, in Sweden, we wouldn't say, I'm post-colonial, right? But I mean, it's still, it's a bit of a spurious argument. So like, well, because we don't use the term, then we can't use it as a theoretical lens, right? You know, to me, for example, queer theory is much more productive in the South African context than, say, LGBT studies, right? Because many men or women who desire other men or women suffer would not identify as gay or lesbian. So to me, queer theory allows precisely that flexibility of focusing on practices rather than identities. So precisely for that reason, to me, it's very, very appropriate to the South African context because it allows you to talk about people, what they do, without boxing them a priori, say, oh, here is an online community for gay men. Well, no, because many of them actually disalign from any identity category. So it's more productive to talk about men who are looking for other men who have sex with other men. So it's like, no, these are longer expressions, but they are more refined because they allow to tell you what they do, rather than what they want to do, rather than who they are. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and I guess, making such clear divisions or borders that, okay, the queer is only used in X, Y, and Z is actually ignoring all the ways that it's already been used, for example, and so on. And the same goes with other theoretical categories. But I guess why I was kind of interested, because for the first time, I mean, the context where I work in is in Indonesia, and actually the queer, I also thought that, okay, it's not part of vocabulary, but actually because of the satellite TV channels, it was actually the queer as folk, or I mean that was the TV series where people picked up the queer before having done any academic searches for queer theory as such. So again, I guess one has to do with the circling of terms and concepts and the multiplicities and so on. But I thought it was just very interesting the way that people kind of, saw queer as folk as being the queer that they started talking about at the circle of middle class gay men, for example.
Any more critique?
No, this isn't critique.
No, I'm fine. I love critique.
Yeah. I'm just interested if queer is anything that is odds with the normal, the legitimate and dominant. Would you consider cougars, like the women who date younger men? to be queer.
Look, I how am I getting out of this? I am more reluctant. I'm reluctant to say who is queer. To me, queer is more of an academic enterprise. So it's queer is more of a verb of what I try to do. So in other words, try to rethink ways of reading certain cultural artifacts like advertising. You know, if in many ways, however, if I had to answer your question, if we can put a label on people as queer, I would say yes, they are. They go against a lot of societal normativity. The fact that it's only older men with a belly who can actually date a younger woman and no one would give a damn. But if you are an older woman and you date a 20-year-old twink, then you like, oh my God, like, you know, this is out of... So in other words, they are queer. They go very much against a lot of societal norms. Then whether they are queer in their daily lives and practices, that I don't know. But if we take it as a representation, in my view, yes, they are. And good for them.
Can I add something to this that reminds me of that Easter report, who's a heterosexual woman and sometimes pejoratively, derogatorily described as the academic hack.
Yeah.
Thing. And she was asked the question, are you queer yourself? See that? She said, within certain discursive regimes.
Yes. True,
so
yes.
I can leave it open.
my other interest, like, what, you know, I guess, do you all work with notion of identity? Because we can start a bit now anticipating the discussion this afternoon. Now, are you all working with notion of identity?
Explicitly, yes.
Whether you use identity, identification, persona, I don't know, whatever. It's like, do you kind of, yeah. Whether explicitly or not explicitly, do you usually work with notion of identity?
Not explicitly, but yes. Definitely,
yeah.
If you're working on people or categorization,
yes. Boundaries between different ethnic or linguistic groups our age, even though I find it very hard and I've tried to stay as far of identity as I can, but I can't entirely leave it out in my PhD work.
Right. And have you, because the other tricky bit for me when you work with the notion of identity, like, do you separate between identity, like, bigger than so race, gender, sexual identity, and say more localized identities, good student, good wife. I mean, do you make the distinction or not?
My solution has been not to use the word identity, but I'm actually if you are talking about norms.
Right.
And kind of like the, for example, when I was analyzing, well, not single, not advertisements, but various kinds of visuals that government and various organizations were portraying, I would be reading norms, looking at such local things, which would only gain meaning in a very localized context, not necessarily in a global setting. But I don't know if it really answers to. But
no,
really,
it seems to. Yeah, okay.
In a sense, relating it to that sort of discussion within the intersectionality discussion that the unpredictability of what can we call, do we already always know the categories that we want to deal with, or are there sometimes surprises and the ambiguities in those? So I guess that's what I became quite interested in when I realized that do we always need the naming in order to talk about intersectionality?
I'm not working on identity per se. I have to teach it, and it's not always very pleasant. But at the same time, I find it personally useful to navigate in the different social settings that my life consists of. I find it comforting and, yeah, a useful tool.
Identity.
Yes.
Okay. No, that's fine. I'm not here to proselytize anyone into desire. I'm just curious because to me it gives me an entry point for this afternoon for intersectionality, which is very much all based on categories / identities and their crossings.
I guess because most people are not very analytical about these things, and they really use stereotypes and categories when they identify people.
Yeah.
And when you have to navigate in different worlds, it helps you to pass, to build on that notion of identity, that you perceive yourself as being the kind of set of, or ensemble of categories and stereotypes that other people see.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, am I understanding correctly? You're saying that identity as a category of practice, then, because it's a category of practice,
yes.
then become an easy way, as a category, it becomes an easy category of analysis because it's already there in practice. Am I understanding
yes,
correctly?
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, more or less.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah?
Don't want to be dominating at all, but just something that
okay.
came to my mind, what
mm-hmm.
you just said, also kind of actually brought it here to some of the open questions that I have for my own research is this kind of notion of strategic essentialism and this kind of how it sometimes creates space and agency.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and
exactly
I'm actually
what I was
yeah,
saying.
And I'm thinking as an academic.
Thank you.
Do I fall into the trap of always condemning it? Or like allowing the space to, like what you were just saying, like focusing on this and you don't see
the elephant passing
by. So that's what I'm kind of like close. And I think this is kind of like an ability to be able to distance oneself or the love to certain, like you said earlier, love to certain theoretical debates and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Does it hinder or allow us to see what's happening
and
around
I,
us?
Well,
so
I think what you are saying actually made me think of the fact that identity is such a personal thing. It's very easy to grasp because we can all very easily understand, okay, identity, yeah, I have that one and that one, and he or she has that one. And that may be one of the reasons why it's not working. Personal.
Well, I think it works. I mean, it's as an analytical category. I mean, it works as long as you're precise in specifying how do you define identity, right? You know, is it, you know, do we define it like as acts of positioning, discursive acts of positioning? If you define identity, then you know it's a way through which we position ourselves and we position others. You know, to go back to Davis and Hare work on positioning, it's fine. It's just that to me, social life and social life through language is not just acts of positioning. There's much more that goes on, and I think also my skepticism about identity. And to go to your strategic essentialism, I am in principle positive to strategic essentialism as long as people are very open and clear that they said that they are doing this in act of strategic essentialism because it opens up, I completely agree, it opens up spatial agency, blah, 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 it has meaning. However, identity can backfire tremendously. And I've written a paper, especially in medical contexts. So the point I'm trying to make in that paper is that looking at the way in which doctors and patients, in this case, how doctors position the patient, and how that positioning results in a specific type of diagnosis. So, In this case, the patient, myself, I had a tonsillitis, so in Swedish, halsfluss, and it was in Sweden, so you know, the most democratic country in the face of the world, you know, and doctors are fantastic or whatever. And so, and then as soon as, I mean, it was very clear it was a tonsillitis, right? And then, but then when I said that I was dating a man, the tonsillitis turned into the symptoms of HIV/AIDS. I'm not kidding. So, which, to me, it's interesting how that, you know, I never said I'm gay. I said, you know, I'm dating other guys. So interesting that, you know, I didn't use identity culture. So then, of course, she made the first leap, which, of course, is that, you know, I'm homosexual for Berg in Swedish. And they said, well, you know, if you are homosexual, then it can be HIV. I said, no. And it's like, why? Because I know what my sexual life looks like, and it's nothing to say. To me, it's interesting how once you get boxed into the so-called risk group, what happens? The problem is that the whole risk group is a big myth, because ultimately there is no such thing as a risk group, but there are risk practices. So the doctor never asks what kind of sex I've had, you know, if I had unprotected sex or whatever. Those are the things, those are the questions that she should have asked. Not say, well, you know, you can be homosexual and be and have a relationship with another man, but doesn't mean that you need to have sex with that man, right? You know, you can have a romantic relationship without any sexual intercourse. And that doesn't, so in other words, the chances of getting HIV and AIDS are practically nil if you don't have sex with the other person, right? Especially if you don't have, you know, and on top of that, you know, you have to also have unprotected sex, and so on and so on. So that's where, to me, identities backfire tremendously. But then, they backfire also in another way, go back to the strategic essentialism. So strategic essentialism, to me, is good as a short-term strategy. And I'm talking about the South African context. So the whole South Africa is based on identity politics. And the whole black economic empowerment is, I'm positive to black economic empowerment as a short-term strategy through which you try to re-empower a group that has been disempowered for centuries. But, and this is a very controversial point to make, but made in South Africa as well, is that if in 100 years' time we're still here with strategic essentialism, that something has gone wrong, right? Terribly pear-shaped. Because as a queer theorist, I believe that we should live, and I might be, you know, very utopian, but we should live in a world without categories. It doesn't, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. Like, after the moment in which you turn the wheel of power, and if you succeed in turning the wheel of power, in trying to make disempowered people empowered, well, at some point, you know, race should stop being and so salient, right? Because ultimately, what we can end up with is with a kind of reverse situation, right? Where there's another form of discrimination. Now, if we live in a world of categories, then discrimination is always going to be there somehow, right? And I know it's a very controversial part. People have said that I agree.
I think I'm very pessimistic about it, because I think that human beings have categories for the past. Years and even more. I think I don't think we can get rid of them in 100 years. At the same time, I think we can make acts of deconstructing identities ourselves. That's possible, and little by little this may help. But what I was saying earlier about the usefulness of identity as a personal tool in personal life is based precisely on the fact that I think that stereotyping and categorization is such a... I don't believe in the man, in the human being. And we are that. We do that. And it's based on that. You can use that to your own advantage. You can try to deconstruct it to a certain extent. I wish it were like that.
No, I understand.
I think it's a beautiful dream.
It's a beautiful dream, yes. It's a beautiful dream, and it's a dream worth dreaming.
Yeah,
but
sure,
perhaps not getting rid, but sometimes making them less salient. What I mean, like, kind of, kind of, a bit of, like, erasing them a bit and kind of reassessing them. So, the kind of, that's to me the most important. I mean, questioning them and trying to problematize them.
But I think, I'm sorry, I'm talking too much here, but it's so interesting. I think doing that also means that you have to engage in it in all aspects and domains of your personal life. And this could be a very unsettling and discomforting experience. I think it becomes very personal.
I'm not sure I'm following you.
Okay, to get rid of the categories and identities and so on, that would mean that you really have to engage in that deconstruction and erasure on a very personal level in all your practices and all your acts and all that. And I think that's you have to be very, very strong.
Yeah.
And people will think that you're crazy. But it's fine.
That's what people think about me, so it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. No, it's interesting. I'm not saying that I evolve, of course I use categories, of course I use acts of positioning, of course I use them strategically, especially with my students in South Africa. But precisely because of the type of society that South Africa is, where identity categories are so relevant, I mean, they're, of course, they're relevant everywhere, but in South Africa, it feels like they are exponentially more relevant than anywhere where, like, I am black is important. And I'm not saying that it shouldn't. I'm saying it has a specific meaning at a specific time, whereas I'm white is nearly a taboo, right? You can't really utter it and make it like a sign of pride, right, because of the history of the country. Right? So that's where I come in, and I try to unsettle that those searches, not to make my students feel bad, but just to make them realize about what implications acts of positioning have, whether as form of empowerment, and we'll go back, you know, this afternoon, this is a very nice quote from Judith Butler about, you know, identity and how you ultimately, you are just staying in the same system of power. Right? So if the aim of our aim is just to reshuffle power, then it's fine. The cake will remain the same. It just will have a different color. If our aim is to change the system, then we will have to think in a different way. You can't change the city. You can't have deep transformation just by working within dichotomies and working within categories. If you want to really change the system, you have to think in a very much more radical way. And that's what Judith Butler said in 1990, more or less. And I mean, I completely sympathize with what you say, but just to me, it's important to make people think that with strategic essentialism, with identity category, you can go, let's say, from here to here. But if you want to make the big leap of changing the system, you don't do it with identity categories.
Strategic essentialism. Precisely because it was very fresh to actually read Kimberly Kershaw's article on the claim, because I realized that, like, she is trying to describe the dangers of the essentialism.
Yeah.
I mean, in a very concrete way,
yeah.
how black feminists were not able to join the strategic essentialist notions of black activists nor the feminists. So.
Yeah.
I think that's a very, I think the context where I'm working, I guess the question about power is very, very important there in terms of asking the question, so what does it do and for whom?
Yeah.
And in terms of, not really kind of like taking it outside the kind of wider context and implications.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking about the kind of nationalist, quite racialist, connotations or effects that certain essentialist strategies can actually end up having.
Mm-hmm.
just talking about like the pink washing of LGBTI, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think there's, you know, one has to kind of remain cautious of the uses and the effects of, of such things. So.
I think we need to have to move this discussion to the lunch table. So there is, in Lotte, in Bethlehem, there is a paper research, and please also those not coming to the seminar, if you want to join us and continue the discussion, you are most welcome. And my suggestion would be, we have coffee here shortly after 12:30 already. So we could come maybe here a little bit earlier, and if you have PowerPoints or stuff, so we could set up so that we kind of could start immediately 1 o'clock, so we would have full 3 hours for that. The door is, the door will be open, we cannot close it.